Welcome to DeltaCast, everybody. I'm Eric Jackson, here as always, Mark Blumberg.
Hey, Eric.
Hey, Mark. And special guest today, Matt Kaiser. How you doing, Matt?
Doing well. Thanks for having me.
So, Matt, you're an assistant professor in the College of Medicine at Penn, and you're a psychiatrist who studies flies.
That's right.
So, how did you get started in that? Why flies? Why now? And what are you learning? And what are you most excited about these days?
Yeah, so I mean, I've been a neuroscientist for half of my life, basically. When I went to Brown and became really captivated by the neuroscientists there, and had a really formative experience as an undergraduate with Mark Baer, who's a guy who's been studying synaptic plasticity in developmentally regulated fashion for a long time. And then in my PhD, worked more on how synapses form, how the brain becomes wired during development. But this was during an MD-PhD at Penn, and I decided to do a residency in psychiatry, which was sort of the first major choice that I had to make in many ways for what I would end up studying. And I've said before, it's sort of a tactical decision in some ways, but I really was fascinated by behaviors and feel like this is an era in neuroscience when those were where all the most exciting questions are, basically.
So when you started off and you're doing basic developmental neurobiology and you were doing axon guidance, is that what you were? Synaptogenesis.
Really, yeah, really synaptogenesis.
So how synapses form. When did you decide, were you interested in behavior back then, or did you have some revelation?
Honestly, I think I was always interested in behavior, but it felt more remote. You know, I was interested in how the brain becomes wired with implications for how that would affect behavior in adulthood. But it seemed like the tools were really changing so that you could start to ask more nuanced questions about behavior. And that led me to psychiatry. And then at that point, I knew I wanted to be studying behavior more directly. And so, I was increasingly fascinated by questions about sleep, really, more so than aggression. So the aggression stuff has come more recently. Really fascinated by sleep and seeing a lot of patients during my training that had sleep abnormalities, circadian abnormalities, and starting to wonder about how those things all align together. And Amita Sehgal, who's Howard Hughes investigators at Penn, and that's where I was during my residency, was someone who shared these interests with me. And I sort of came to her at the end of my residency and wanted to begin asking questions about sleep circuits and behaviors using the fly, which is the model system. And so why the fly? I think that the tools you have available to ask precise questions about how neural circuits give rise to complex behaviors are basically unparalleled. And that's changing, to be honest, because the tools in mammals now are sort of growing at warp speed.
So what can studying flies tell us about human behavior?
Yeah. No, I mean, that's a question I get a lot, especially as a psychiatrist, right? There are two things that we can talk about. One is sort of historical, right? And what has it told us about behavior as opposed to what will it tell us about behavior? So what it has told us about behavior is from the early random mutagenesis screens, and really from the beginning in the 1950s of behavioral genetics, it started with fruit flies. Okay. It started with Seymour Benzer, someone moving away from the phage sort of DNA research and starting to ask questions about, do genetics control more than just, you know, how our bodies become formed and developmental programs? Do genetics actually affect the behaviors themselves? Which now it seems quaint. But that was a revolutionary idea, I think, at the time. And he used the fly to be able to show that single gene mutations can change behaviors. And I think the most fascinating of all of those were circadian behaviors. So we all, you know, operate on a sort of imposed 24-hour rhythm by the light-dark cycle. But there was a raging debate decades ago about whether that's endogenous, meaning we have internal clocks, or whether it's just because the sun rises and the sun sets. And so it was in the fly that it was shown to be an endogenous molecular rhythm where almost every cell in our body has processes that are going on a 24-hour cycle. And some of those lead to behavioral rhythms, rest activity rhythms and stuff. And it turns out, fast forwarding many decades later, that the basic molecular architecture is shared from flies to humans. And humans with a mutation in the period gene have dysfunctional circadian rhythms. And this is advanced familial sleep phase syndrome, where people go to bed around 7 p.m. and they wake up around 3 a.m. and they have a mutation in the period gene, which is the first one that was identified in the fly. So I think there's a lot that we can learn from the fly that we can scale up to systems, especially because by and large, the neural logic and the molecular basis of these are conserved, believe it or not, which I think is something that should be emphasized because, you know, directing all of our research towards what looks like the most obvious way to learn something about human disease and human behavior is not necessarily the best approach. Casting a wide net and trying to take lots of varied approaches, I think, is a sort of the strongest way in my mind.
So given everything that you've seen so far in the fly world versus the mouse world versus the rat world versus if you want to understand basic processes at any level, you would choose the fly?
I think there's a lot to be gained from all of them. I would choose the fly, but that's not necessarily because I think it's going to be the fastest route towards giving me answers that are going to change, you know, psychiatric disease. In part, you know, let's call it what it is. It's sort of selfish. I really like it a lot. I think that it's fascinating. I think that the level of control that we can have to interrogate brain function and neural circuitry is just something that's unparalleled. And so that is very attractive to me. Now, I will point out, though, as a psychiatrist, we haven't exactly revolutionized treatment of psychiatric disease by studying it in rodents, right? So it's not like that's been a, you know, incredible path, right? So if you look back at the 1950s and you look at the number of mechanistically unique medications for cardiovascular disease and psychiatric disease, they're about the same, mechanistically unique, maybe two or three. Fast forward a half century. Where are we with cardiovascular disease? There's 20, 30, maybe more mechanistically unique. In psychiatry, how many are there? Still two or three. Right. And the drugs that we use, medications we use, were serendipitously discovered. Lithium, Thorazine, right? These weren't people who were looking for drugs to treat people with mental illness. And most other medications we have are derivatives of those, right? They're chemically unique, but they're derived from the same foundation. We don't have intelligently designed medications in the neurosciences across the board. There are very few of those. That's just not how things have worked out. And so there's a vacuum any way you look at it. From a therapy perspective, I will say, as a biologist, you'd think that I'd be focused on medications, but it's really the behavioral interventions that are more targeted and are the most effective. And those have arisen from basic science, right? So someone like Joe Ledoux, who's done phenomenal work on fear conditioning and fear extinction, that's sort of where the work has grown for how we treat PTSD, for instance, in humans with prolonged exposure, for instance, right? And that's grounded in basic science work. The medications really have not worked out that way, though.
Can you make that link a little more explicit? In a lot of ways, they seem like vastly different worlds, right? And then on top of it, you're talking about studying a fly. So how do we make that link more explicit?
Well, they are vastly different worlds. There's no doubt about that. But if you rewind medicine a couple decades and then a couple more decades and a couple more decades, how unscientific does it all start to seem, right? And you go back a couple hundred years and it's basically not scientific at all, right? And so we've made advances, a lot of it emanating from basic research that has dramatically changed medicine, right? Psychiatry is lagging. There's no doubt about that. But I don't think that we necessarily should think that it's not biologically based. And I don't mean to say that it's only biologically based, but the way that life experiences alter our behaviors, there is biology in between those two things, right? And so there are all kinds of changes going on at a neural level and how circuits are functioning that give rise to our behaviors. And that is all very much changed by experience. And those things are increasingly, you know, tractable to be able to look at, right? Now, I don't know how many decades it's going to be. And I direct the, you know, neuroscience education for early psychiatry residents at Penn, for instance, right? And it's a bit of a tough sell sometimes, right? Because they're saying, well, do I need to know this stuff? And is it going to affect my practice at all? Well, I like to say, I think a couple years from now, a couple decades from now, the answer is likely to become yes in some facets, at least.
So like, well, let's say in terms of writing a grant when you're trying to make this sell, like, how do you do it?
Well, I'm only a year in, so I'm just, you know.
Well, it's interesting. NIH is funding a lot of fly research, or no?
Well, I think that NIH, it depends on the institute, okay? But no, I think NIH certainly funds a lot of fly research. A lot of it is, you know, our basic developmental questions, not necessarily behavioral questions. There's a lot of, you know, I know best sleep and circadian stuff. So certainly they fund, NINDS in particular, funds a lot of sleep and circadian work that's done in model systems, fly and worm, for instance, okay? But again, there is every reason to believe that the molecular basis of those behaviors is going to be conserved up and across phylogeny, right? It has been for circadian rhythms. Circadian and sleep are linked. There's, as I've mentioned to a lot of people, there's been beautiful work from Amita Sehgal's lab and from Giulio Tononi and Chiara Torelli identifying potassium channels as a common denominator. So brainwide excitability that's potassium channel dependent as being a major regulator of sleep. That wasn't something that people were particularly attuned to before that came out of the fly work. And now it's becoming an active area in mammals and in humans.
So it's interesting, you know, we share an odd connection in that you study sleep in an animal, an invertebrate, that because it's an invertebrate, does not have a cerebral cortex. And I study sleep in a mammal at a developmental stage when the cerebral cortex is not doing very much. And we live in a world of sleep, which is extremely corticocentric. And so I think one thing that I find interesting about studying sleep is that you're not tempted to think about the cerebral cortex because it's not there. So you don't have to think about slow wave activity and all these things that are such a big thing in the mammalian sleep world, but that don't exist in the fly world. And so have you thought about that? I mean, is that flies are interesting because you have to focus more just on behavior and not so much on the particulars of brain regions that link up with mammalian adults.
That's correct, right? So the flies have a non-homologous brain, okay? And there is a lot of evidence that there are electrophysiological correlates of sleep in the fly and in zebrafish. And there's a really nice evidence for there being different sleep states throughout the night, for instance, in the fly, as measured by, for instance, arousability, okay? But there's no cortex. And I think it gets into interesting questions, which is what is the sleep that you're most interested in, for instance? Is it more REM-like? Is it less REM-like? What about the sleep that I work on and that people who work in worms work on? Is the more rudimentary sleep just a generic sleep, or is it the equivalent of REM? And, you know, as evolution goes on, non-REM sleep is added, or is it the other way around, or is there there's no analogy at all, right? These are all open questions. I think what we know though in the fly is that you have all the behavioral aspects of sleep, right? Which until EEG is how sleep was studied anyways, right? So flies are, they have it's circadian gated, right? So they sleep more at night. They're less arousable. They have a strong homeostatic response. So if you sleep deprive them, they rebound just like we do. They respond to caffeine. They respond to modafinil. They respond to most of the other same drugs. And for me, the most interesting thing is that it's a age-dependent phenomenon. So let's say flies live about 80 days and humans live about 80 years, okay? Flies, this is amazing, recapitulate sleep throughout their lifespan in the same way that humans do. So young flies sleep more, just like babies, and as life goes on and flies age, their sleep becomes more fragmented with time, just like in humans, over, you know, days instead of years. So I think it's an incredible system to study these age-dependent questions in sleep. And my particular interest is why we sleep more when we're young and what sleep does in the developing brain. And that's the overlap that Mark and I share.
So yeah, we're just a handful of people in this room is probably a good chunk of the people who care about sleep and non-human animals developmentally speaking. So what is your, when you think about sleep and development, the role that sleep plays in development, how do you, what are the sorts of the keywords, what are the key concepts that you think of functionally?
Well, I think you and I do really share very much overlapping ideas there. So, you know, my question in my postdoc was building on this famous paper that's now exactly 50 years old from Rothwarg and Science in 1966 that was sort of one of the first times that people were putting EEGs on infants essentially and seeing that there's more sleep and there's much higher component of REM sleep. And they put forward this very influential idea that sleep is provides these endogenous signals that are necessary for patterning the brain in the absence of sort of other interactions with the environment. So my perspective on that was this is a phenomenal concept, but one for which clear evidence had been elusive. And that's what I really wanted to tackle. And I chose to use the fly to do that. And what we were able to do was for the first time map a specific circuit that controls ontogenetic sleep changes. And this ended up being a dopamine dependent circuit in the fly brain, where there is a certain small set of dopaminergic neurons that are less active in a young fly brain. Those neurons normally inhibit a sleep-promoting region in the fly brain. And so they're less active, it's developmentally controlled, and that's what accounts for increased sleep amount and sleep depth in young flies. And then with that, we have quite a tool, right? We have a sleep ontogenetic specific circuit that we can manipulate. So now we can inappropriately perturb that circuit at various developmental periods and ask what the function is of sleep specifically without sort of the messiness that's normally involved in various ways of disrupting sleep. And when we did that, we found that specific circuits that underlie complex behaviors, that their developmental program is in fact perturbed. Okay. I am most interested in the idea that rapidly growing regions of brain are most susceptible to sleep deprivation early in life or sleep, you know, disturbances. And in particular, we think that these rapidly growing regions of brain are adding a lot of synapses. So I think that one really interesting possibility is that synaptogenesis during these critical developmental periods, which is really happening at a robust clip, that sleep is an important signal for that to proceed normally.
And how closely do you think the developmental features of sleep in flies map onto things like in mammals? REM sleep is the predominant state.
Right.
So how much of this is activity dependent? Is there evidence of activity dependence in flies that are contributing to things like synaptogenesis?
So what do you mean by activity dependent?
Is there enhanced activity during sleep? Is there anything that looks like the generalized activity that you see?
Oh, I see. So you're not saying activity in those specific synaptogenesis circuits necessarily.
It could be. In the case of mammals, you know, as you know, these animals are doing a lot of, there are lots of different features of the sensory motor system that are activated, phasic activations, PGO waves, other things like that. All of these things are generating just generalized activity. Some of it's quite specific. That's a big question is, you know, whether how much of this is instructive and how much of it is permissive, to use the terms of the trade. And then, so is there any evidence of enhanced activation in the fly brain during sleep?
That's
like you see in mammals.
Yeah, that's a great question. And actually what we've looked at has been limited to the sleep circuits themselves. So whether the enhanced sleep that you see is allowing for a state of heightened activity, which is then be required for increased synaptogenesis, we don't know. And we've been doing experiments to try to address that, but the jury's out still.
Let's change gears a bit.
Sure.
What's one thing in your field that people talk a lot about behind closed doors, but in public spheres or at, you know, talks or lectures, they don't really talk about, that you think should be talked about more?
Well, it depends on which thing we're, so if we're talking, focusing on sleep, for instance, I think that, and you know, to be fair, this is a problem that's not limited to flies, but I think that what's happened is we identify a lot of different genes involved in regulating sleep in the fly. And people have identified a lot of different circuits that are involved in sleep in the fly. But there's very little that's been done to link any of those things together, right? So you do a screen, you find out that X gene regulates sleep. But what about all the other, like 10 that have been identified? And why do we have so many different areas of the brain that you can activate to promote sleep, for instance? And people will say that, you know, this is a sleep center, that's a sleep center, this is a sleep homeostat, that's a sleep homeostat. But are there just multiple redundant systems? How do these things all integrate? And I don't quite know why, but across fields, the sort of impetus to bring together disparate findings is often not there. So I find that pretty, I find that sort of frustrating because I don't really feel like there's a major effort to see how it all fits together. And increasingly in the mammalian brain, there are, especially with the use of optogenetics and chemogenetics, there are a lot of different brain regions you can activate that sort of induce sleep. And is it that one area is responsible for REM and one is non-REM and one is induction and one's maintenance? I mean, how does all this stuff fit together? So I think from a sleep-centric view of things, that's sort of one of the areas that I would gripe most about. From an aggression view of things, it's the variability in the behavior. That is a real problem. And I don't think that people are very honest with their data, which I like. They're not just, they're showing scatter plots so you really can get a flavor for that. But, you know, why is it that in these aggressive assays, which are frustrating and very finicky, that sometimes two flies will not fight at all, a zero in 30 minutes, and other times you'll see 400 lunges and they are all supposed to be identical from a genetic perspective. They were all handled identically. They all saw the exact same environment, right? All the assays are done under the exact same conditions in side-by-side wells. Why does that happen?
I think you're discovering the variability of development.
Right. Perhaps.
And certainly this isn't specific to sleep and aggression, but all behaviors. I mean,
right.
You see variability being this huge problem. And I'm wondering if it's the fact that it's easier just not to talk about it, or is it the fact that it's almost like there's a lack of respect for complexity?
So I'd say this. It depends also what your research goals are, right? And so if I'm studying humans and perhaps rodents, but humans for sure, and I'm seeing a lot of interperson variability or intertrial variability or something like that, I think that there perhaps is more interest or should be more interest in understanding where that variability is emerging from. In the fly, I'm not sure how much we would get out of it necessarily, you know, and it's really not the strength of that research tool, to be honest, right? Like, we're interested in digging into these sort of the molecular control of these events, and the inner fly variability, you're right, is viewed as a problem, not as an interest. And in large part, it's because we don't know what to do with it, I think, right? They're genetically identical. Environments are identical. We don't know where it's coming from.
That raises a question that I was thinking earlier, and that is, you know, most of the fly work that I've seen described is all in the adult, basically, and after the pupal stage.
Oh, lots of people do larval work.
So what is going on with larval work? And has anybody been studying sleep in larva?
I am.
You are.
Yeah, I'm the guy.
This guy.
I'm the guy. So
what a coincidence.
Yeah. Well, that wasn't planned, listeners. So most, I would say historically, a lot of the strength of fly work has been in questions of real neural development. Okay. Within neuroscience, I should say, where people are looking at, you know, body patterning and, you know, looking at fundamental questions of how organs develop, things like that, let's say. There is a good amount of behavioral work in larvae, looking at sort of feeding behaviors, learning assays, things like that. No one has looked at whether larvae sleep. I don't think that given how few people are interested in questions regarding sleep and development, and now let's limit that to number of people who work on flies who are interested in sleep and development, it becomes a pretty small group. Okay. So I'm actively pursuing that area. And the reason I am is, one, because I think it's really interesting, but two, because most neural development in the fly is occurring at larval stages. And so if we really want to be able to ask these questions, we need to understand whether there are sleep states in larvae and then ask what happens when we perturb those and how does that affect neural circuit development and adult fly behaviors. So I'm fortunate because at Penn, David Raisin, who was the first person to show that C. elegans have a sleep state, and his close collaborator, who were the worms, and his collaborator, Chris Feng Yang, who's a bioengineer, they're both at Penn. And so we've started a collaboration last fall. It's something I've been sort of waiting to do once I had my own lab. I brought in a very talented larval Drosophila biologist, Milan Suparek, who's a postdoc in my lab. And we're up and running right now. So we definitely see that there are quiescent periods in larvae. We see that these are reversible. We're testing whether there are arousability changes. We see already that there are, that it's homeostatically controlled. And now we're able to use this incredibly rich knowledge of sleep control in the adult and ask how that translates. So we can activate known wake promoting neurons, known sleep promoting neurons. We can look at mutants that are short sleepers and ask how that affects larval sleep. So we're heavily into this. We're really excited about the work. We think it's clear that larvae will have a sleep state, and then we're going to be able to start asking, what does that do to nervous system development?
That's really exciting, and it's great to hear that you're doing that. I think there's several things that I'd be really fascinated to know down the road. One is do you see, when I was asking earlier about increased activity during sleep, that's where I would expect to see it most obviously would be in a larva. But also, what kind of variability exists in the larva that could be predictive of variability that's occurring later in development? Because there might be things about the early developmental stage that would be predictive. That would be fascinating.
Yeah, so that's quite a neat idea, right? Where we could look at larvae, look at their rest activity, look at their sleep, and then let them emerge as flies and look at it in adults and ask whether the variability or the patterns are conserved fly by fly. That's a really neat idea.
Because it's a fascinating idea when you, especially animals that go through metamorphosis, what is preserved from that pre-metamorphic state?
Yeah, that's a neat idea.
It's always been an interesting issue.
So I think we would like to do that. And the activity questions you're raising, we've thought about them, but not quite the way you're bringing up. And so it's neat to think about that right now as we're talking, because one of the things that you can do in larvae that's a little more challenging in the fly is to express indicators of neural activity, pretty broad ones, and
watch
we can just watch them glow. We can watch them during sleep states. And we had been thinking we'd look and ask what's happening to sleep neurons and wake neurons at these transitions. But we'd like to look at other brain regions as well and see whether there's correlated activity changes and things like that during these quiescent
That'd
periods.
Fascinating
work. Yeah.
So I want to cycle back to what Eric was talking about, these behind closed doors question, and I want to make it more explicit. What's pissing you off these days?
What's pissing me off these days? Well, let's see. So so I think that there's scientific stuff that pisses me off, and then there's structural stuff that pisses me off.
Let's talk about all of it.
Yeah. So the scientific stuff that pisses me off, and it's, you know, this is just life. But I find that there are some really high-profile papers that my thinking has been heavily influenced by them, and I think they're beautiful, that turn out to be totally unreproducible. Hmm. And, you know, that it's, of course, everyone knows that that's a problem right now. And I think there's a lot of press about it sort of in psychology in particular, right? But it's not limited to that. And there's been, you know, some evidence for that and a lot of evidence for that in basic research too. But some of these are really elegant stories that are very, very clear-cut experiments. They're not really complex experiments, and it turns out to just not work at all. And
is there a common theme underlying the failure to replicate, or is that also variable?
So there's some things that are technique-based, right? That's I'm a little more – it's frustrating, but on the other hand, techniques are finicky, and I'm aware of that. And, you know, that I can see being more user-dependent. But there are other things that are framed as just basic, foundational, elegant biology. This is how this works, and then it totally doesn't work that way. And you know, and so then, you know, you sort of hear rumblings about it. You talk to people who may be in the know, who may know people who are in the lab, who then sort of say, yeah, I wouldn't go down that road if I were you, because no one's getting that to work. So that.
So going down the road as far as that.
Following it up.
Right.
And among those rumblings, are there fraud rumblings as well? Is that come in, or is it more just
no, just
problems with the technique?
Problems with science or sloppiness and things like that. But, you know, stories can be told in such an elegant way, and it gets so exciting, right? Because and in many cases, for some of the things that have been most frustrating for us, it fits perfectly with everything that we're thinking, and then it totally doesn't seem to stand up.
I just recently finished my PhD, one of the messages is, oh, well, it's really important to craft a good story, right? You have your work, you have your paradigm, but it's really important to craft a good story. And it seems, and I think that is important, because when you get it out into a journal, how well you tell the story is going to dictate how well other people receive the results, right?
And it's fun. It's fun.
Probably a big reason why we get into science, why you find science so exciting. But it almost seems like the problem is that motivation of, okay, well, we need to take this stuff and find a good story. It's almost like the story is set out or is established initially, and then the researcher or the scientist is like, okay, well, how can I show this?
I think the danger with any science is when the story starts to dictate your perception of your results and the experiments you're willing to ask, you know, and unfortunately the demands on all of us to be productive and tell a good story for all sorts of reasons, including getting grants, those pressures can lead to a distortion of what the scientific practice is supposed to be about. I think it's just sticking to really, I mean, one thing I try to do now in the lab more than I ever tried to do previously is just to constantly doubt, question, and say, how do you know that? How do you know that? How do you know? Just not believe it, no matter how excited I am by the potential of the finding. And that's taken a long time, because hearing these sorts of stories that you're talking about, Matt, about all of these, you know, failures to replicate, which are all over the place now. You know, that's scary. Now,
and people find you annoying when you do that as well.
Well, right? I'll tell you an interesting story. I was talking to a social, very well-regarded social psychologist once about this very issue. It was involving a fraud case out of the Netherlands, which was a very famous case in social psychology, where almost everything that this guy was publishing was fraud. And this one person I was talking to was an American academic, and he said that he's not so sure that there was such a problem there, because after all, he himself cannot replicate more than 30% of his own work. And I feel like if I ever have, you know, the one or two experiments that I've done out of whatever 110 papers that have not replicated, they keep me up at night, you know? So, I mean, it's a completely different, you know, mindset there.
Yeah. And I definitely don't think, I think some of the issues that we've run into, I don't think that in any way, shape or form that this is fraudulent. I think that you realize though, that the observations that you make can just be incredibly dependent on all kinds of things that may be outside your control, frankly, and there's no way to perfectly replicate stuff. I do think by and large, certainly within the small field that I'm in, things are self-correcting, right? So the some of the errors that people made 10 years ago, you know, now people know that's not quite right, and people have gone in, you know, in different directions. And I like to think that that's how science works. I think the other major frustration, it's actually not yet a frustration because I'm just starting and I've had a lot of really, really wonderful support. But you look at funding, and to me, it seems so obvious that this is a great area of investment for our country, and it's historically has paid huge dividends. And it, you know, I realize now I'm almost like a small business owner, right? Like I employ a bunch of people, I pay for their healthcare. Right. So I'm like, hey, empower the small business owner right now, you know, but funding has become really tight. And sometimes it feels like funding agencies are interested in things that they believe will pay dividends really quickly. But, you know, I think that the unexpected is what pays the biggest dividends. And we've had tremendous, you know, scientific impact in our country over the past half century by just funding a lot of stuff. And unexpected areas lead to huge transformations. Oh, that's and I'd like to see that continue, because right now, I'm not, you know, having to write lots of NIH grants, but that's going to be starting really soon. And it has to be very, very directed. And you have to be explaining how it's going to sort of pay off to some degree. And, you know, exploration science has been the foundation of stuff for a long time here. And I'd like to see that be reinvigorated. It seems like, doesn't seem like that should be very controversial.
Well, it's ahistorical. I mean, I think the folks who are putting these pressures on the translational side of things, is they're not reading history. Like you just said, history is that, you know, people discovering, going their own way, studying things that they find personally interesting leads to the serendipitous great findings that start whole new fields. If you try to target, looking, you know, how's the war on cancer going, folks? You know, what's the bang for the buck there? Things have improved, but very slowly compared to the amount of money.
And there's still cancer. That's how people still look at cancer. It, too, is the fact that there's still cancer. And it's like, oh, well, what have people been doing in this field because there's still cancer? There's
very basic work on immune function, right, has now opened up this new pathway for immune therapy in cancer, which looks incredibly promising. But that's grounded in basic research that I seriously doubt at its onset were people saying, this is how we're going to cure cancer. You know what I mean? It was funded for different reasons. And I don't think that's dried up. And I feel like the people I've interacted with at the, you know, federal funding agencies have been nothing but wonderful and supportive. But you want to make sure that you're funding a lot of things, some of which will have, you know, end up having huge impact, some of which won't. But if we're limiting ourselves to things that are the most powerful big labs only, I think that we're really cutting ourselves off in a very different way than we have historically.
I'd like to ask a sort of a biographical question, because you have this very sort of developmental systems perspective on development, and it's not typical of people with your background, I think, coming out of straight up, you know, developmental neurobiology. So I'm just wondering what has been your saga intellectually in thinking about development and moving more towards an open-minded sort of systems account of how these things emerge.
I think in many ways it's really not all that directed, right? I mean, I was definitely sort of a molecular cellular neurobiologist, right? And sort of, as I was saying earlier, the implications are, you know, about how the brain gets wired and about how, you know, abnormalities in behavior can arise. I think with my residency, although I'm not someone who treats kids and treats developmental issues, I became much more interested in the behaviors themselves, but I am at heart a developmental neurobiologist. And so that became sort of this area that I found myself in, where I really approached my postdoctoral advisor and said, you know, I want to work on this sleep behavior, but I want to work on development, and started slowly finding, you know, more papers that had sort of, were based on this Rothwarg work of the original sleep ontogeny, and slowly finding this much bigger field that existed with people like Mark. And, now looking to people like you to help, you know, teach me more and provide even more guidance in those areas to some degree, right? And an aggression in other social behaviors in the fly, you know, it's another great example where I'm sort of realizing that people are looking at the neural circuitry behind these behaviors in adults, and they're looking at neural circuitry of behaviors in larvae, but those are sort of these two generic states, as if sort of there's nothing in between. And it turns out that there's a lot going on early in the life of a fly. And we don't know, you know, we didn't know anything about sleep. Now we know a little more. I'm actively very interested in aggressive behaviors and how those change, but even learning and memory, right? We know very little about that. And so I'm very intrigued by those sorts of ideas as well. How do young flies learn differently than flies that are older? Sleep is a very, very critical step in consolidation of memories, for instance, right? And young flies sleep a lot more, but do they learn in differently because of that, because of their increased sleep? Instead, how are those circuits hooked up? These are all questions that we're eager to ask. And so, you know, we're sort of spreading ourselves across a couple different areas, but they're all linked by this overarching issue of how complex behaviors emerge during development in the setting of a very plastic and dynamic brain, right? And that's really at the heart of what I'm most interested in.
It was great to have you here, Matt. Thanks so much for joining us today.
thank you guys very much for having me. I've never done this before, so.
Well, how did it feel?
I'm scared to listen to my voice later on.
I think you'll be pleasantly surprised. Looking forward to all the work you're doing, which I think is phenomenal, and I'm personally probably one of your biggest fans now, and looking forward to seeing what you do with larvas. I'm really interested in the maggots.
Oh, it's funny because in the worm field, they do these experiments where they put individual worms in little arenas and they call it worm motels. And they were trying to call ours magmotels, but one of my graduate students came up with the larva lodge, which is much better. Nice. So we have larva lodges now. Okay, so we already have a name for it, so it's got to become good.
The story precedes the science.
There it is.
Yeah. All right, great.
DeltaCast is a production of the Delta Center at the University of Iowa. The Delta Center is supported by the Department of Psychological and Brain Sciences, the Department of Communication Sciences and Disorders, the College of Education, the Office of the Vice President for Research, the College of Liberal Arts and Sciences, and the Obermann Center. All of the wonderful music you heard during today's podcast was written by my good friend Josh Kaufman. Thank you, Josh. You can learn more about the Delta Center by going to www.deltacenter.uiowa.edu, and you can also follow us on Facebook.